My guest today, Phil Rees, is a Welsh-born reporter and television director who has won more than a dozen international awards for his work. After 20 years at the BBC, he set up his own production company, Out of Office Films, based in London, and most recently presented a six-part series on Al Jazeera based on his book On the Roots of Terrorism, Dining with Terrorists, of which the British Journalism Review wrote, quote, "This thoughtful, controversial book should be compulsory reading for every editor, journalist, and politician before it is too late." For the past 30 years, Phil, an Oxford graduate, has covered war zones over the entire world, with a particular focus on struggles that involve groups and individuals who their governments and much of the world consider to be terrorists. Countries in which he has reported and produced award-winning documentaries range from Sri Lanka in the 1980s to India and Kashmir, Algeria, Cambodia, Colombia, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Algeria, Kosovo, Lebanon during Hezbollah's fight to end Israeli occupation, in Gaza during the first Palestinian Intifada, and in Afghanistan where during the 80s, he filmed frontline fighting with both the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul and the Mujahideen guerrillas. Phil was one of the first journalists to enter Kabul when the Taliban fled in November 2001 and has met and interviewed Taliban fighters in the tribal areas of Pakistan. He has also written articles for the New Statesman, Sunday Times of London, Independent, The Guardian, and numerous other publications, and what is most intriguing, he is a regular contributor to the Italian gastronomic magazine Slow Food. Today we're going to be talking about the killing of Osama bin Laden and, more importantly, its implications for U.S.-Pakistani relations. Welcome, Phil Rees, to Takes on the World.
Hi, how are you, Jeffrey?
I'm very good. Glad to have you on the phone. It would seem...
Well, that makes me sound very old, by the way, when you read all that. It makes me seem that... Wow.
That's an abbreviated version. You have had an amazing life and amazing experiences, and I'm actually going to get your book and read it because description of the recommendation by the British Journalism Review sounds like right on point. Getting to our subject of today, it would seem from the bitter exchanges we have been seeing taking place on a daily basis between Pakistani and U.S. officials, the triumphalism that the U.S. experienced in the wake of bin Laden's assassinations has kind of backfired, and the event, at least the way it has been publicized, has created more problems for the Obama administration than it's solved. What's your take on it?
Certainly, it has caused problems. I mean, I know that many Muslims were very concerned about the way he was killed, that it's kind of legitimized that kind of extrajudicial killing. And we know that, for example, the Israelis complimented it because they've done the same thing to certain Palestinian militant leaders. So I think there is more disquiet outside of the United States about the method of his killing, even though, of course, most people believe, you know, he was clearly a bad guy, as it were, and certainly his capture is a good thing. Yeah, in terms of that region, in terms of the Pashtun belt where the Taliban emerged from, he, I think, was regarded as quite a hero, actually. And that's because he gave up all his worldly goods in Saudi Arabia, his wealth, and he decided to live a very religious and simple life. And I think that's probably quite hard for Europeans, for Westerners to understand the amount of respect that did honor him amongst those people, even though they may not approve of his actions. He was certainly not seen as a corrupt man. And, you know, in our world today, there are very few uncorrupted Muslim leaders. And I think that Muslims are very aware of that.
Now, how is he? This is he's viewed by this way in the Pashtun community. But in fact, how important was he at the time he was killed? We hear Al Qaeda has maybe 100, 200 fighters in Afghanistan, and then we're told very quickly, amazingly quickly, that the amount of documents seized in the bin Laden home were enough to fill the library of a small college, which sounds quite extraordinary, both in the rapidity in which they made this announcement. Tom Donilon of National Security Council made this announcement that they have all this information from the capturing or killing bin Laden, not interrogating him. But how important was he or Al-Qaeda at the time of the assassination?
Of course, most of us, and you know, certainly includes me, believed that he'd become totally marginalized in terms of the leadership of Al-Qaeda. And in fact, what is Al-Qaeda? It doesn't have a command and control structure in the conventional sense of an organization, some kind of secret structure. There was none of that. I mean, obviously, there was an element of that, as you said, amongst maybe 100 people. But even then, his role had been one of perhaps giving sort of inspiration. I mean, every now and then, a tape would be released, and some of them have become quite quirky recently. You know, he spoke about global warming, for example, and that being the fault of Western capitalist societies. And I certainly felt that a lot of his recent statements had been influenced by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Now, this is a group that involves a lot of Americans, in fact. Samir Khan, Adam Gadan. Adam Gadan is from California originally. And they're under the kind of spiritual auspices of Anwar Awlaki, who again grew up in the United States. All of them speak, obviously, fluent English. And they're the ones who've been blamed. I mean, the Fort Hood killings, then the Detroit failed airliner bombing. These were all linked to speeches and discussions with Awlaki, in other words, that he inspired them. Even if he didn't have a direct role, certainly in the Fort Hood killings, when the psychiatrist killed a number of fellow soldiers. So these guys certainly, I believe, took on the kind of ideological lead. Now, clearly the United States government has now said that bin Laden had a more hands-on role. Now, I don't know. I mean, we've already heard, shall we say, some spin on the story of his killing. Now, that's not altogether, I mean, it's not necessarily surprising that such something so politically significant for the American administration would have a bit of spin on it. That's part of politics. But clearly the stories originally that, you know, he perhaps was armed and that his wife was used as a shield, and all of this has proved to not been true. So actually what he was doing in terms of running the organization, I mean, they claimed he had a role. Well, I think he had that figurehead role anyway. Nobody's surprised at that. But I haven't seen information now that specifies that he had any direct command and control function. And from the way that he was communicating through, in a way, some drives, I mean, that's not really a way to be ordering people to do something, is it? I mean, I think that's a fairly cumbersome way to do it. And certainly I don't think that there was a lot of comings and goings at this place in Abbottabad, which, of course, was, you know, very much in the middle of this rather quaint, you know, city north of Islamabad. I've been there many times. And, you know, Abbottabad, a large building there, if there was a lot of comings and goings, would have drawn a lot of attention, for sure. So, I'm dubious about the role he had in a hands-on way, even though I think he was, as it were, inspirational. The fact that he's dead, though, won't necessarily end his inspirational role. I'm afraid, you know, that's sadly the case, certainly in terms of the security of the United States. I don't think it makes a huge difference, because he did die a martyr in terms of what most people who are associated with him believe. And moreover, they said that he knew from a speech he made after 2001 that he would die a martyr, and that would happen, could happen soon, it might happen later. Well, it took nearly 10 years. But I don't think that it will therefore affect the overall conflict that we've got today. And if you look at the sort of conflicts that were inspired by him, you know, the Taliban in Afghanistan and Al-Shabaab, the Somalian group, they're going to carry on as before, really. There's no question of them changing tact or doing anything differently because he's passed on.
Well, it's interesting, the Taliban have launched a couple of important attacks in Afghanistan, and a relatively handful number of Taliban fighters kind of took over the central part of Kandahar for like 30 hours. Extraordinary.
Exactly.
where the U.S. is the occupying power.
If I could just step in there, Jeffrey, I mean, thing is that the way that the sort of media largely describes the Taliban is that they are the kind of outside force somehow, that you've got a government of Karzai and you've got, you know, institutions, and then there are these kind of outsiders. Well, I mean, I traveled with the Taliban in 2008, and I've been with them before. I mean, you know, they are the people, actually. I mean, if there are outsiders, obviously it's the NATO, the ISAF forces, the you know, the largely Western forces there. So these guys are very much part of the community. Some people oppose them, but, you know, they all know each other. They interrelate, their families interrelate. So it's not particularly surprising that they can't be defeated in some way, because they are part of the people, certainly in the Kandahar areas, the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan. And, you know, your listeners may know that. I mean, the Pashtuns, they're kind of country, if you will, and obviously they're a sort of tribal, a traditional identity, but it spans both Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it splits them down the middle, really. So they largely don't see that border as being terribly significant, because if you ask them what their first identity is, they'll say Pashtun, rather than Pakistani or Afghan. It's a result of a British colonial governor who decided to split them up, because that was about as far as the British could conquer in British India. But it's a problem, because it actually is quite an unstable aspect of the kind of national setup there.
Well, you have traveled or spoken with the Taliban over the years. Have you seen any changes in their attitude, in political attitude or philosophy in general, or do they want to go back to what we in the West look at as kind of a very strict Sharia state?
Yeah, they're remarkably consistent, actually. Jeff, I mean, the people of the Pashtun areas are quite remarkable in a sense. So they don't seem to want anything that the West has. And I remember speaking to one person in the tribal areas, you know, a Pashtun sort of elder, and he'd made a long speech, and this was in Pashto, and I don't speak that, but various bits of English came up in between, as they do, pepper it with bits of English. And he started saying, we don't want your 50-inch TV screens. We don't want your New World Order. We don't want your United Nations. And we don't want your, you know, rich ways. And you know, basically, it's amazing that if you look at their history, they've fought outsiders, because they will not have outsiders change their way of life. And this is so embedded into their lifestyle that it's like the first rule of being a Pashtun is that they will fight outsiders. You know, it's in their blood. And they often don't have other jobs, really. I mean, there are no jobs there, and it's the women who do most of the work in the house and bringing up the children and the cooking. So they basically just hang around with guns. And then you say, well, there are foreigners there. Then they've got a reason to sort of exist, really. And, you know, they've defeated the British three times, obviously the Soviet Union. You know, I think they're on the way to defeat the West. Certainly, if the West isn't winning, if NATO isn't winning, an insurgency is winning in that sense. If it's a stalemate, the insurgency knows that they're going to be there longest, because they are from there. Therefore, they're not being crushed, and therefore the West is losing, in my book, along that definition anyway. And I've even had a Taliban commander tell me that he's looking forward to a war with the Chinese. This is a war that hasn't happened yet. But seeing the emergence of China as a regional power, you almost look forward to a Chinese invasion in some future date. So this is, I mean, it's jaw-dropping on one level that they aren't, you know, they can't engage. And yes, their women live in terrible, you know, they live in segregation, and they do live in very poor conditions. But, you know, it's very hard to break into this when both men and women are so defensive about their traditions and believe that they are doing the right thing. They're doing the right thing for themselves. And for years, you know, and I can count to you the number of, you know, women and charity organizations and people who honestly believe that they're doing a good thing, very, very noble people. Including, I remember one lady from the United Nations I met when the Taliban were governing in about 1998. Remember, they took power in Afghanistan in 1996. And then, of course, they weren't defeated, of course, but they disappeared. They went into the mountains in 2001. But there was a woman from the UN, and she started finger-wagging these old guys about women's rights and schooling for women and things. And you just saw there a kind of pointlessness, or at least it wasn't going to get anywhere. And, you know, this issue of certainly of gender politics is, of course, ignites such passions in both sides. But in my view, it doesn't go anywhere. Nothing has really changed. And in fact, being lectured to by the West kind of makes them go back in their shell somehow. I mean, I have no easy answer to how to improve the sort of rights of women there, but I'm not sure that you can either do it on the barrel of a gun or by sort of wagging your finger at how better Western lifestyle is than theirs, because quite blunt, frankly, they seem quite happy with theirs.
Well, it's interesting that now we hear they get their funding from the drug industry, the heroin trade, but I recall before 2001, the United States paid reportedly $40 million to the Taliban to curtail heroin production, and they did.
And well, absolutely. I tell you, it's one of the huge kind of myths about the Taliban is that they were drug dealers and they were making their money out of drugs, which is kind of filtered through somehow in terms of general understanding of the region, because one of the very few things that the Taliban did do, because they actually executed opium farmers, they had a very drastic way to deal with it, but they actually succeeded in significantly cutting down the amount of opium that actually left Afghanistan. It's been going up exponentially after the Western-backed governments have been in there. And I think that the Taliban have, you know, joined the circus, as it were. But in terms of drug prevention, the Taliban were right on.
Some people have argued that's the reason the United States went into Afghanistan is to keep that drug trade going. The United States seems to be involved in countries such as in South Asia, with the Green Triangle, Emerald Triangle, in Central America, and where the CIA goes. So goes the drug business.
Well, I tell you, I mean, listen, I don't know, and clearly, you know, you're in the realm of kind of conspiracies here and black operations.
Right.
But one thing I know for certain, and this is during the first Afghan war, when I was in the American consulate in Peshawar, and there were a couple of guys who'd obviously gone to the other side, as they said, you know, they had big beards, but, you know, they were drinking Budweiser and eating hot dogs, so, you know, clearly they were American. And, you know, we played some darts with them and some pool. And we talked about this question. And one of the guys said, and obviously this was private comment, I'm not saying that it reflected American government policy, but he was clearly some kind of operative. He said, hey, man, what can we do? You know, these guys will smuggle in drugs, smuggle in the guns for us. They want to bring the trucks back full of opium. You know, we can't really stop it. You know, we got to get rid of the Soviets. So, you know, we turn a blind eye. I mean, so be it. Now, that was what, you know, a guy told me during the first war. Now, that's not my only experience of U.S. policy towards drugs. There was one that came from certain members of the ATF regarding what was going on in Jamaica in the 1980s. Now, it's a separate story, but a similar point, and it's this, that, the Americans under Reagan wanted this guy called Edward Seaga to win the election there. He was anti-Cuban. And he was also a major drug dealer, and this has been much documented since. And basically, the Oval Office stopped interception of his drug operation because he was an ally of the United States. So I feel very confident that, you know, when it gets little snippets of firm information, that when it comes to drugs, the United States and its, shall we say, its policy objectives, the policy objectives tend to come first. And drugs can often be used to allow certain people to maintain their position as an ally.
This is a subject for a whole other discussion, and a very interesting and important one. I want to get back to the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and going back to the bin Laden assassination and the position that the Pakistan government, particularly the ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, was put in, either being complicit with the knowledge of protecting Osama being there, or incompetent, not knowing he was there. What's your take on that?
I've been to Abbottabad, Jeffrey, a few times, and it is a garrison town. It is, you know, it's the American version of West Point. The Pakistani version of West Point is there. It's full of soldiers. I, I went, you know, the times I've been there, I think it's twice that I can recall specifically going in there. You also have to travel up this area. You go up what they call the Murray Hills, and you know, it's like it's very cool in the early winter there. So it's a kind of hill station. And remember, this was a British cantonment as well, under the days of British India. I believe Abbott, it was named after a British British army officer called Abbott. You know, the two times I've been there was to meet Pakistan Army generals. On one occasion, I certainly remember being on their veranda and they'd get a gin and tonic at 6 o'clock. It was like something out of the old Raj. But what you'd also say is that the whole place was, you know, under sort of pretty serious lockdown if you were a suspicious character. And certainly if you were a Western journalist filming, there was somebody on you within, you know, 30 seconds. You know, remember that the Pakistan army has been targeted by the Taliban recently. You know, there are checkpoints around the place. So I find it, it really begs my credulity to really say that nobody within the Pakistan military and intelligence establishment knew anything about bin Laden there. I mean, I'd go so far as to say that's impossible. Now, does that mean that the government knew, that Prime Minister Giuliani, did he knew? No. Well, no, I mean, it's very possible and probable that nobody within the political establishment knew, and that only a few people, but probably pretty senior people within the intelligence community knew. I think that's all you need to have known, but that itself poses major, major questions for the United States to deal with. Now, I think these, you know, they probably already knew this. I mean, that's why they didn't tell the Pakistanis when they went in, because they knew they couldn't trust them. I mean, we've all had hearsay evidence, and this is the point, nothing concrete, that, you know, the ISI, that is the very powerful Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, that is made up of basically spooks from all of the different armed services of Pakistan, that, you know, they're some senior division, and there is a division called the S Division, which is involved in kind of Afghan affairs, and that they were basically working certainly parts of the Taliban. If you go back, of course, to the early 90s, the Taliban really was a creation of Pakistan in some of the madrasas of Western Pakistan. And in fact, there was a man who later became president, General Musharraf, who within the Pakistan military was involved in basically training the Taliban. Now, the reason for this is that Pakistan sees control of Afghanistan as part of its own, in a way, security doctrine, that it needs strategic depth to its west because of the power of its neighbor to the east, India. So, in a way, they wanted a pro-Pakistani group to be running Afghanistan, not have one that is either pro-Iran or pro-India, pro-Russian, which are all the major powers that have basically fought over Afghanistan over the years. So they've always had an interest there. So that's part of, that's sort of understood. Now, they've also needed to develop militants to act on their behalf in order to sap India of its strength. And therefore, in terms of Kashmir and in terms of the kind of conflict with India, they know that they can't fight India in a symmetrical way. So they've resorted to asymmetric warfare. So they were certainly training militants to try to basically attack India to ensure that the Indian armed forces used up much of its resources fighting these militants. Now, all this was kind of known. Now, then what happened in 2001 is that the United States basically, you know, wanted Pakistan's cooperation because it knows that it's actually at the very center of all things to do with Islamic terrorism, certainly in the South Asian context. As a result of that, you know, General Musharraf, who was then president, said, well, of course, we'll give you our unstinting support, was his phrase, we won't be doing any funny business, of course, with these groups after this, because they're listed as terrorist groups in the United States. So there was this sort of pretense of working with the U.S. On it and sharing intelligence. Now, nobody really fully trusted each other, but nevertheless, this kind of went on. And I think that people like myself, we fully knew that Pakistan was working with elements of the Taliban. And this would do two things. It would allow them to have a stake in the future, and moreover, would have a kind of bargaining chip, because I think Pakistan knows that the United States and the West will leave Afghanistan at some point, just as they left, by the way, in 1990 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And they kind of left a mess there, which Pakistan felt it had to deal with that mess afterwards. And Pakistan knows this. So they wanted a seat at the top table. So we knew that they had contacts with the Taliban, and therefore would, you know, have a kind of negotiating tool when things, you know, and there will be a negotiated peace settlement, because that's the only way peace will come. And therefore Pakistan wanted to make sure it had its agents and its power brokers there, rather than those from the rest of the Tajiks, who are from the north, who are close to Iran and Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So everyone like myself has kind of known this, so we've had little evidence. But to think that bin Laden was actually in a military garrison town is actually, I think it's remarkable. And of course, there's been a kind of ritual taking place now, because I think the U.S. has just stopped, I think, a centimeter short, barely that, from saying, you knew all about this. Now, in my view, they're virtually saying that, but they stop short because I think they know that if they alienate Pakistan too much, they've lost a lot. They've lost their leverage. What leverage does the U.S. have? I mean, amongst the populace of Pakistan, involvement in Afghanistan, the U.S. is deeply hated. Polls suggest sort of 80-90% oppose U.S. involvement there and believe the U.S. is a major force for wrong in the region. But what they've got, what the U.S. has got, is, of course, checkbooks to give to the Pakistan military. And these guys have been happy recipients of American money. Many of them build houses in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And, golf courses have sprouted at some regularity recently in the areas around Islamabad and Rawalpindi, where the army is concentrated. So the Pakistan upper echelons of the military, and indeed some of the political leaders as well, have done very well out of their quote cooperation. So I do believe that there was an element of double dealing going on here. I think that any other explanation, and that is that they had no idea, or that nobody had any idea that bin Laden was there, is just completely implausible.
Well, it's obvious that both the United States and Pakistan have different priorities in Afghanistan, and that Pakistan is obligated to keep the money flowing and the Americans reasonably happy. They have to play what the Americans call a double game, and Americans, the American populace knows next to nothing about what Pakistan's priorities are. They probably can't even find it on a map. But this is something that one of the things that concerns Americans, and not just Americans, is the fact that Pakistan is a nuclear-armed nation. And I guess the Pakistani are concerned that the U.S. will try a similar operation in seizing Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. What do you think the chances are of that?
Well, I think it's a... I think if they didn't know that bin Laden was there, I mean, would you possibly trust them to look after their nuclear arsenal? I mean, I think it's if they're that incompetent, that didn't know that the world's most wanted man is rubbing shoulders or in the same town as most of their generals go for R&R, and they're the higher echelons of their military are trained. It doesn't say a lot, does it, for their ability to sort of impose security on anywhere or anything. This question of the U.S., and the sort of nuclear issue in Pakistan is one that I've always found slightly mysterious, because when I've spoken to U.S. diplomats, I've always considered Pakistan a very unstable country, by the way, but they've always kind of seemed not to worry too much about Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. I find that kind of strange in a way. We hear all the time about Iran and its nuclear, well, it doesn't even have any, certainly, according to, U.S. intelligence reports. I mean, the CIA made a large report, I think, just about 2 years ago, said that Tehran had given up its nuclear ambitions. Yet, if we are, you know, if we read the newspapers, it's as if Europe and the United States is about to get nuked, you know, any time now from Iran, despite the evidence. Yet, when we, you know, talk about Pakistan, there's very, very little said about it. Now, partly that explains the fact that when you read about Iran, a lot of that is a ritual politicking, by the way, by both sides. So that partly explains it. But it also makes me wonder, well, do they have any safeguards? What has the United States done in terms of, in terms of managing Pakistan's nuclear arsenal? And I wonder, and of course, you know, the U.S. is fully aware of the Pakistan situation for some time now. I don't know, because certainly I would be concerned if I was, a U.S. diplomat there, and I would have tried to find ways to ensure that maybe the United States has got its people on the inside, or that they're absolutely working very closely with the people in charge, because I think that is something that probably is more tangible for them to do. For them to infiltrate the ISI and get access to the ISI's managing of the Taliban in the Pashtun areas is pretty difficult and pretty impossible, especially since to get the intelligence on these very, very closed communities, the U.S. has to rely on the ISI. But I think when it comes to the nuclear arsenal, it wouldn't surprise me if the U.S. hasn't done some deal with Pakistan that means that they've actually can watch it firsthand what's going on. I have no firm evidence of this, of course. It's just a feeling I have, because it's never quite red flagged in the way that perhaps it should be. And I don't think it has in the last week, of course. It hasn't been red flagged, as far as I can see, in a way that, you know, if they are so incompetent as they claim, well, how could they possibly guard them? That would be the conclusion I'd reach. But yet, that hasn't come out of the State Department, has it, or indeed from President Obama himself?
Well, we know there are a number of U.S. special operatives there with the CIA or even with some other agencies, and perhaps some of them are involved in keeping an eye on the nuclear arsenal. I want to go back to the case of Raymond Davis, the CIA contractor operative who killed two Pakistanis who some allege were actually ISI agents who were following him. That incident, coupled with this incident, seems really to have set things boiling in the Pakistani population. Is there a possibility at some point that the whole thing could collapse, that the amount of money the United States provides as generals will not be enough? That there could be an uprising, some kind of an uprising, not dissimilar, but something like we've seen in other countries in North Africa, Middle East?
Well, if you look at Pakistani society, it's very volatile on one level, that you get, you know, a lot of demonstrations and people, go berserk on some of them, and they end up with riots. But on the other hand, remember that you haven't got as educated a population, certainly an educated youth, as you had in Cairo, in Tunisia, or indeed Syria. So you've got, you don't have certainly the communications for the internet and all that kind of stuff there. It's at a far more embryonic state. You've also got a much more docile democracy. And this sounds an odd thing to say, considering there was no real democracy in Egypt or Tunisia. But and theoretically, you have democracy in Pakistan in terms of, you have elections every now and then. But the truth is, those elections are managed. People are hauled en masse to vote, and they vote to somebody who's just given them a bag of chicken and rice. And there's a very feudal political system there. And I think that really prevents that kind of social uprising that you saw in Tahrir Square in Cairo, that managed, you have to have a lot of people. You have to have a massive and concerted and organized unity of people to unseat an authoritarian government. And I don't think you're going to see that in Pakistan. You haven't got the necessary ingredients there. And the other thing is that, I know we've seen from recent events in Egypt and some things unraveling, but there was a huge amount of unity as to what the goal was. In Pakistan, there isn't a clear goal as to what Pakistan is, about what Pakistan should be. Should it be an Islamic state in a more serious way? In other words, implementation of Sharia. Well, I mean, a lot of people don't want that, but a huge number do as well, certainly amongst the poor who largely live by those rules anyway. So you've got, I think, a lack of real sense of what Pakistan is as a country. And if you recall, going back to 1947 and the division of British India between East and West Pakistan and what became India, effectively what was chopped off from India were the Muslim majority states. That excludes Kashmir, of course, which is why there's been a lot of problems there since, because that was a Muslim majority state, but that was not included in what at the time was West Pakistan. Now, we know that since then, in 1971, there was a war because the people in Bengal and Bangladesh, what it became, didn't like being governed by the largely Punjab Pakistanis over in the West. But increasingly, different people, well, what is Pakistan? The Punjabs are in the army. They largely, have the power base there, and the Sindhis from the south. We've spoken about them earlier, the Pashtuns, who feel themselves more Pashtun than Pakistan. And then you've also got Baluchis, who also feel that they are more sort of, they're not particularly Pakistani. So you've got a real sense of, where Pakistan is going. I mean, I think it's a real state in crisis in that way, that it was sort of cobbled together. And in a way, the only thing that unifies it is Islam. And that's the problem. That's why the politicians and others resort to that as the last thing that keeps a sense of Pakistan together. It's an Islamic state next to this massive Hindu neighbor that, if you believe the Pakistani papers, is always trying to, attack Pakistan, which, of course, I don't believe is true. But it has a problem of its identity, and therefore I don't think it's got a clear sense of where it's meant to be going and what role the military should have, because there's very little pressure for genuine democracy outside a very small group of sort of well-educated young people.
So it's a major class division in which you have, there are many, many Pakistanis here in the United States who are well-educated in business and so on, and politically active. The most active Muslim community in the United States are far and away Pakistani, and they're very nationalistic in that sense. But what, you, of course, you're saying is that they represent only a certain segment of Pakistan.
A lot of the most able people in Pakistan actually left, of course, yes, and left for countries like the United States, so which itself is a tragedy. I mean, I'm not blaming your listeners who are on this, but obviously your viewers and listeners, saying, well, I mean, this is not, my parents emigrated from Britain to the United States when I was young. So, I mean, it's not that. That's a very healthy thing. But it does, weaken the fabric of that country that they've left, inevitably, when talented people move there. But, there's a kind of joke in Pakistan, which is not really a joke at all, says that basically it's governed by 200 families. And I think that is true, that there are old, it's a very feudal political establishment, and despite the fact that there's been occasional democracy since independence, and remember there have been huge periods of military rule, that despite that, the occasional and the kind of, there has been the semblance of democracy at times recently as well, certainly there have been elections, but those elections really have just been through various sort of interest groups who've allied between the main parties, the Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party. There's very little sort of genuine sort of democracy there.
Phil, and at this point, actually, this is a very enlightening conversation. We could go on for a long time. We've come to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very, very much for being our guest today, Phil Rees. What is your website where people can find your information about you?
Well, that's right. I tell you, it badly needs to be updated, I'm afraid to say,
yes.
Technology and me. But www.philrees.tv.
That's R-E-E. It's Phil, R-E-E-S.
E is in the United States.
Right.
But that's R-E-E-S.
And Phil, thanks so much for being our guest, and I'll see you again on Al Jazeera.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.